Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast of the Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. I'm Joshua Youngkin. Today we're joined by David Berlinski and Michael Denton. A longtime critic of neo-Darwinism, philosopher David Berlinski has authored over a dozen books, and this year published 1, 2, 3, Absolutely Elementary Mathematics. Michael Denton has been a medical geneticist for over 20 years, a researcher on the mammalian eye, and is the author of two books, Evolution, A Theory in Crisis, and more recently, Nature's Destiny. Both Dr. Berlinski and Dr. Denton are senior fellows with the Center for Science and Culture at the Discovery Institute. On today's podcast, Berlinski and Denton each state their primary objections to neo-Darwinian theory. For Berlinski, the mathematician, the problem is quantitative and methodological. For Denton, the scientist, the problem is empirical.
If I wanted to amaze and dismay my Darwinist friends with a relatively short, cogent challenge to evolutionary belief, what argument or evidence would I offer? In other words, if I wanted to not say something long, but something short and cut right to the heart of Darwinism, what would I say?
There's a double temptation. One is to offer examples. And we've had so much experience with examples. We know they persuade the person who's offering the examples, but they never really succeed in persuading the other side. Why does the elephant have a trunk? Why are there no intermediate-sized trunks among the elephants? Yeah. Why aren't pigs born with wheels mounted on ball bearings? I mean, those sorts of things. Why does evolution take the strange divagations that it does? Highly channelized courses of development and evolution. Because it's at the level of rhetoric, the Darwinian establishment is very adept at counter-rhetoric. If you haven't seen elephants with intermediate-sized noses or giraffes with intermediate-sized necks, that's because the fossil record is weak, a lot of time is involved, there's no reason you should have seen this. If I wanted to go beyond the level of rhetoric, and of course, 90% of the activity when it comes to the issue of Darwin, whether it's credible or not, is rhetorical exchanges, not really scientific or rational exchanges. If I wanted to go beyond that level, I think I would ask questions that I don't think the Darwinian establishment can answer successfully. And the questions strike to the nature of what we want in a biological theory. They're quite different from the usual kind of questions, answers that are being posed. I'll give you an example that I've been using since the 1990s, and that's the evolution of the whale. Now, the evolution of the whale is a majestic story. It's a majestic story in several respects. One, the whale is a majestic creature. Anyone who's seen a whale must be impressed. He's not impressed, he shouldn't be part of the discussion. And the second, it's a majestic story attached to it because, according to current biological theory, the whale is not a fish, contrary to its appearance, but a mammal. It's a sea-going mammal that has made an incredible adaptation to life in the open ocean. So much so that it's completely incapable of living on land. You remember those pathetic scenes of beached whales. They can't get back. That's quite sad, all on its own for other reasons. But the story is that there are a series of intermediate steps going from a land-dwelling creature. On one podcast, I said some dumb cow munching grass decided to become a whale. Of course, every Darwinist on Earth said it isn't a cow, come on, as if that were the gravamen of the argument. It's something. Something land-dwelling. But here's the question. If you were to take a Chevrolet Corvette built in 1954, decide you want to make a Nautilus-class submarine out of the thing, give it to a lot of engineers and say, fellas, go do this. Do it for me. I think it could be done. But we all have a sense of the engineering complexities. To do it would be a big, big, big project. The question I'd like to ask a Darwinist is, give me a quantitative estimate. How many steps would be required to change that Chevrolet Corvette built in 1954 into a Nautilus-class submarine? I don't want you to give me a quantitatively precise answer, but I want you to give me a ballpark estimate. Say it's off by an order of magnitude one way or another. And I think if we were talking about Chevrolet Corvettes and Nautilus-class submarines, the answer would ballpark be 50,000 changes, 60,000 changes, maybe 100,000 changes, if it's feasible at all. I kind of suspect it could be done. Now, I want the same answer for the transition from a land-dwelling creature to a sea-dwelling creature. How many changes were needed? Mm. Now, why would I be interested in that number? Let's call that number the X number. And this is the point that the Darwinian community never finds curious. If we knew that number, which is an accessible number, we know enough biology to grasp that number, we could compare it to the fossil record. The fossil record has about 10 intermediate fossils between a land-dwelling creature and an ocean-going whale. If there are 10, let's say the tides of time have buried another 100, it's perfectly plausible. But if there are 50,000 required changes, there should also be 50,000 intermediates according to standard Darwinian doctrine. If there is an inequality, a strong inequality between those numbers, the number of fossils that we have observed, padded with the number of fossils we might have observed, were it not for the injuries of time, and the number of changes, morphological, cellular, biological, physiological, anatomical, that are required to make that transition, then we could assess the plausibility of what is one of the most interesting Darwinian sequences in the record. That's never done. Mm. That is just never done. No Darwinian paleontologist has ever said, we expect there to be 50,000 sequences in the whale transition sequence because we've computed the number of changes that are required. But wouldn't you think, Darwinian fellow seekers, that that's an obvious first step to take in making your scientific claims quantitative? Not rigorously quantitative, but ballpark quantitative. Mm. It's not done. Mm. The closest that anyone has come to this sort of approach was a German biologist, very fine German biologist, writing in the 1950s, Willy Hennig. He introduced cladistics and a certain statistical methodology, and he was very concerned with quantitative measurements, but that doesn't touch on the question I'm raising. If there would be one question I'd like to pose to a serious, open-minded Darwinian biologist, it would be this. How come you guys never go to the next step, which is a quantitative assessment of your claim? How come you're always showing us nice pictures, one creature developing into the next, and all sorts of arrows connecting them, which of course prompts the question, where do you guys find the arrows? you found the fossils, but where did you find the arrows? That's the kind of question I'd like to ask. And there are dozens of other questions along the same lines.
What do you think that someone would say? Let's say we had a thoughtful, honest Darwinist with us. What would he say in response to your challenge, do you think?
I didn't mean it as a challenge. I mean,
or his question.
Open question.
His question. What would he say in response?
I think he would say that you, David, talking to me, David Berlinski, have a tendency grossly to overestimate the number of changes. When all is said and done, we'll discover that in going from that proverbial cow munching grass to a whale in the open ocean, 10 or 20 changes, masterfully controlled by 10 or 20 genetic switches, are all that required. Mm-hmm. That is to say, I think the honest Darwinian reply would be that the structure of the whale is already in the cow in terms of its potential to become a sea-going creature, but not perhaps an air-going creature. And I think that's a reasonable answer. It's the only conceivable answer, in my opinion.
Yeah.
If we're doing one change after the other by a random variation, random mutations, I think the process is hopelessly slow. Rick Sternberg has an interesting article about that. The window of opportunity is only about 9 million years.
Yeah.
But that, of course, pushes the problem one step back. How come the creature is set up to become a sea-going creature if it's spent all of its evolutionary history on the land? Where'd that come from?
Yeah, oh, that's great. Michael, do you have a
yeah? Well,
a singer for?
I think I would. Yes, I mean the one that I've often used and is.
Could you give it an adaptive description? You know, account of the insect body plan. We're talking about something very important here.
Yes. Yeah.
They can't give it because the fact is that in the history of biology, from Goethe all the way to Darwin, and Darwin himself accepts in The Origin that he can't imagine what the selective value was of these particular plans, right? He says they must have just had some function in the past. But that's hand-wringing. That's just nonsense. Mm-hmm. You have an insect body plan, and of course there's thousands of body plans like this, which are numerical. We said about the legs earlier, right? You cannot explain it in terms of little functional steps. That's the body plan of the insects, right? Up which puts all insects on the planet are based. You cannot give an explanation of it. And I have said that in debates a long time ago at King's. I debated Barry Cox, the biology editor of Nature, and he was dumb with silence. To stand there, as Darwin would have had before Richard Owen, and he couldn't give an explanation for it, right? So that's what I would ask. That's one question. And I would pursue the line into the... I would say, okay, let's take something simpler. Let's take the shape of an oak leaf. Can you give a Darwinian explanation for that? No. An ash leaf? No. The fact that one tropical leaf is this big, and mind you, these are recurrent forms, which are absolutely robustly recurrent through time. So you've got a huge problem now because you've got a mass. I mean, in the botanical world, this is Marco Schützenberger's point, of course. You remember.
We should interrupt. Both Mike and I were close friends of Marco Schützenberger, Berger, who was a French mathematician. And we were very close, the three of us.
Okay.
Yeah, and he, I remember, in fact, I got onto the whole typological structural thing because of... meeting him in his room in Paris, as we both did, actually. And, of course, he took me to a garden, a botanical garden in Paris, and in the, he had a chest problem. He was always panting and puffing, but he would say, Mike, look at all these patterns in the garden. Darwin never explained any of this stuff.
It's absolutely true. There is so much that seems repetitive, structured, but adventitious. In botany, certainly, but biology generally, that the forms, no matter where you look, the forms do not seem adaptive in any obvious sense, nor do they seem singular or unique so that one could say it has to be this form because there is no other. Right. Any form you point to in nature, like the oak leaf, the example that Mike Denton just gave, you can say, well, I can think off the top of my head of 200 different kinds of shapes to assign to an oak leaf. Why was this one chosen?
Right, right.
And yet, if you say, well, that's just the way nature works, there's a certain level of chance, indeterminacy, you know, I've got to choose some shape for a leaf, so this was the oak. But then you miss the fact that these forms are very similar, that there's a coordination between forms, that they seem to be mathematical descriptions so that you can pass from one form to another. As Darcy Thompson noted, and that line of research has by no means been exhausted. The notion of structurally stable shapes persisting in nature that have an explanation that has nothing to do with adaptation. Nothing.
Yeah, this is what you were saying.
And I would also perhaps take the extremely simple example of the enucleation of the mammalian red cell, right? I've already said that birds have a higher metabolic rate than mammals and get by with a nucleated cell. And you can't evolve gradually enucleation. Because you either have the nucleus in the cell,
right,
or you have it out.
Right.
And so basically, these are points I've also used in the past as well. Obviously nobody can explain how the enucleation of the cell occurred gradually, right?
Yeah.
It's impossible, because it's a saltational event, right? And the other thing is that, in fact, there's body plans emerging, like, for instance, the turtle body plan. You will never find intermediates in the fossil record between turtles and other standard reptiles anymore, because in fact the way that the turtle body plan emerged seems to have been saltational. So this is Evo-Devo stuff, right?
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's a few things I can throw at them. I think there's definitely what David said, and also the question of the type. I think that these questions really can't be answered.
As Berlinski explained, neo-Darwinian theorists are happy to provide stories and pictures, but they never supply even a ballpark estimate of the number of changes required to transform a cow-like whale precursor into a whale. Such an estimate to Berlinski seems the natural starting point for evaluating fossil evidence for evolutionary theory, yet is never produced. Denton noted the absence of plausible adaptive accounts for certain leaf shapes, features of the cell, and the insect body plan. This is Joshua Yunkin for ID the Future. Thanks for listening.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.